This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Mining and gas lobby groups are broadly supporting the deal struck between the Albanese government and the Greens to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the country's biggest polluters. But there are lingering worries about the impact of what's known as the safeguard mechanism on future investment. Political reporter Nicole Hegarty explains.
After more than a decade of political changes to energy policy, the CEO of the Minerals Council, Tanya Constable, is pleased a deal's been done.
Companies could be secure in knowing that if they were challenged in meeting their emissions reduction levels in any one year, that they could be purchasing offsets and that the prices were not going to be so high that it risks that competitiveness.
The safeguard mechanism requires 215 of the nation's biggest polluters to reduce emissions by 4.9% a year or purchase offsets to make up the difference. The Greens fell short of securing a ban on future coal and gas projects, instead getting the government to agree to a hard cap on emissions, which will have to reduce from the current 140 million tonnes a year to 100 by 2030. The peak oil and gas body, APA, warns the deal creates new barriers to investment. Samantha McCullough is the chief executive.
That pathway to net zero is going to be more expensive and more difficult because it fundamentally doesn't recognise the critical importance of natural gas in the transition.
The Australian Chamber of Commerce says the key test will be whether energy supplies remain secure and affordable, while the Business Council says it's assessing the full impact of the changes. So, what of the Greens' claim that their amendments will prevent 60 new projects from going ahead? Tennant Reid is the Director of Climate Change and Energy at the Australian Industry Group.
I think it would be fair to expect that gas projects, while they can go ahead, are less likely to go ahead.
Under the changes, companies that use offsets to meet more than 30% of their emissions reductions needs in any one year will have to declare it and explain why they didn't do more on-site abatement. Tennant Reid says while they won't be penalised for non-compliance, any business which relies on offsets, that is, credits that are obtained by avoiding emissions elsewhere, like farmers regenerating land, will face growing costs.
Offsets in the long term are quite an expensive proposition. The less we need to rely on them, the better. But they are a very important part of this policy for the next several years at least.
It's not just the Greens who are on side. Independent ACT Senator David Pocock, who had called for a cap on the use of offsets, is also on board.
As a result of the amendments we've seen and some further commitments from the government, I'll be supporting the safeguard mechanism. The government's committed to looking at a cap at the review, but we should just see this as a start.
That's Independent Senator David Pocock ending Nicole Hegarty's report. The social media platform Facebook has been criticised for not doing enough to remove suspected scam pages. One area rife with scams is the shipping container industry, with people wanting to buy containers to turn them into tiny houses, workspaces, or to use for storage. The ABC's discovered one suspected scam which remained active until yesterday despite getting reported to Facebook. National Consumer Affairs reporter Michael Atkin has the story.
Kim Ellison's wish for a drama-free retirement hasn't gone to plan.
The retirement dream, peace, quiet, nature. Yeah, just nice. Sick of all the drama.
Last year, she fell victim to a suspected scam as she browsed Facebook, looking for a shipping container to turn into a tiny home for her move from Brisbane to Russell Island off the coast. She found a page for what she thought was an Australian company and paid an invoice for $4,500.
We were buying a container home, a tiny home, and when we saw the one with the three roller doors, my mind started, doing all sorts. I thought, oh, God, this could be, I don't know, cabins or, for family, extra family when they come over.
But when she got an email asking for thousands more, she phoned the Melbourne-based company Magellan Logistics and was told she'd been scammed by people imitating the business.
They said that had happened to them. They've heard of this business going on and they're actually ruining their business, their good name.
Good morning, Magellan Logistics.
Mel Wraith works for Magellan Logistics and says they've been inundated with calls from people who've been scammed.
So people were losing $5,000, $10,000, even $20,000, depending on what they were buying and how many.
The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission is warning shipping container scams are on the rise. Chair Gina Cascott-Leib says almost 500 people have reported losing $1.8 million over the past year. It's why the consumer watchdog wants new powers to oblige Facebook and other digital platforms to remove proven scam content.
We're highly concerned about really failure to take action and to respond. It is another good example about why we're looking for these binding obligations to take action when notice has been given.
Magellan Logistics says it's discovered 6 Facebook pages using its name and logo without permission, and Mel Wraith says all have been reported to Facebook as a suspected scam. 5 remained active until yesterday when Facebook removed them after being contacted by the ABC. Facebook's parent company, Meta, declined to be interviewed. In a statement, it acknowledges scammers present a challenge, but says it dedicates substantial resources to protecting its community from fake accounts. Back on Russell Island, Kim Ellison's bought another shipping container. This time, she made sure she could touch it before she handed over her money.
Michael Atkin reporting there. After the biggest street protests in Israel's history, the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has delayed his controversial plan to overhaul the country's judicial system. His government had been seeking more control over the appointment of judges to the Supreme Court, along with the power to override court rulings. Michelle Rimmer reports.
As tens of thousands of protesters gathered outside Israel's parliament, inside, opposition politicians staged their own demonstrations of dissent, banging on tables and yelling shame at members of a review panel that approved the government's contested judicial reform bill. With his country swiftly descending into chaos, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has announced the legislation will be temporarily put on ice until the next parliamentary session in a few weeks' time.
Israeli citizens, I am not ready to tear the people apart. For 3 months, I read over and over again the conversations, and I also said that I would turn over every stone to reach a solution. Because I remember, we remember, that we are not facing enemies. We stand in front of brothers. And I say here and now, there must not be a civil war.
The bill, which seeks to give Israel's religious nationalist coalition greater powers over the country's judicial system, has fueled widespread anger for weeks and reached a tipping point on Monday. Banks, ports, universities and even airports were shut down after a mass strike was called by Israel's biggest trade union. It's not yet clear whether the proposed delay will satisfy the seas of protesters still gathered in cities across Israel.
I'm going to stay here and fight for what 2,000 years the Jewish people fought for. We will fight for this democracy. The world, listen, we will fight for this democracy.
Right now, what drives me is my daughter, my 9-year-old daughter, that I want her to grow up in this country. I want her to have every possibility she dreams of. And that won't happen if this judiciary overhaul will take place.
Critics have said Mr. Netanyahu is pushing through the changes due to his ongoing corruption trial. The Prime Minister has denied those claims. Israel's opposition leader Yair Lapid has called on Benjamin Netanyahu to scrap the judicial overhaul altogether for the sake of the country.
What happened during the past 24 hours is madness. It's a loss of sense and a loss of track. It's proof that this government has lost the brakes. It's dangerous for the state of Israel as it endangers Israel's security. Our home is in danger.
But proponents of the legislation say the bill is needed to correct the country's judicial system and strengthen Israel's democracy and must not be abandoned under any circumstances. They say growing dissent in Israel amounts to a coup. This is Michelle Rimmer reporting for AM.
In India, protesters have clashed with police during demonstrations against the expulsion of the opposition leader from parliament after he was convicted for defamation for comments he made about Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Critics say the government is trying to silence Mr. Modi's critics. South Asia correspondent Avani Dias reports from New Delhi.
Holding banners that say defend democracy, thousands of supporters of Rahul Gandhi, the leader of India's opposition party, are marching to parliament in New Delhi. They start climbing over barricades and they're met with a wall of police holding batons. But protesters like Chetan Solanki try to push through.
Our popular leader Rahul Gandhi has been disqualified from parliament to suppress his voice.
One by one, police drag demonstrators onto prison buses. They're protesting Rahul Gandhi's 2-year jail sentence for defamation over comments he made comparing Narendra Modi to criminals who have the same last name. Ravi Shankar Prasad, a senior leader from Mr. Modi's party, the BJP, says the comments were offensive.
The Modi community is a downtrodden community. Rahul Gandhi insulted them in a public meeting. We have a right to criticise him. We're not hurling abuse.
Rahul Gandhi!
Critics say Mr. Gandhi's expulsion is another example of the Modi government's silencing of dissenters. The government denies those claims, saying Rahul Gandhi's expulsion was in line with parliament rules. The Indian government also recently banned a BBC documentary critical of Mr. Modi, and human rights groups like Amnesty International have suspended operations because of similar pressure. Srinivas Bhadravathi Venkata is the leader of the youth wing of Rahul Gandhi's party Congress.
Only we have to save this constitution and we have to save this democracy.
Rahul Gandhi comes from a long political dynasty. His great-grandfather, Jawaharlal Nehru, was India's first prime minister after British independence. His grandmother, Indira Gandhi, and his father, Rajiv Gandhi, were also prime ministers, and both were assassinated.
But Rahul Gandhi is his family, is a sacrificed family for this nation.
While Rahul Gandhi was trying to rally support to win next year's Indian election, his expulsion is seen as unnecessary. Narendra Modi is expected to comfortably win the vote. But this defamation case is galvanising opposition parties. In a rare scenario, 14 of them have united to file court action against the Modi government, accusing it of misusing central investigation agencies.
We demand that Prime Minister Modi immediately stops misusing the machinery of government and withdraws the expulsion of Rahul Gandhi from Parliament.
This is Avani Dias in New Delhi, reporting for AM.
As an increasing number of tents housing homeless people pop up in a Brisbane park, the Queensland government's today hosting another roundtable to discuss the housing pressures being experienced in the state. The state and federal governments say they've committed record funding to social and affordable housing, but advocates want more new dwellings along with a boost in temporary accommodation. Annie Guest reports from Brisbane.
A couple of streets back from Brisbane's tourist draw card, Southbank, at least a dozen tents are housing homeless people in a large park.
What's it like to be homeless and living in a tent?
Not really good. It's pretty hard. No, hardly any food, no place to shower.
And I see that your tent is amongst a few others. Do you know each other or have you just got to know each other?
We've known each other, yeah. Our boyfriend's dad, our friend, and we did have a few other people here, but they went.
Do you have any path towards a rental home that you can see?
No, I don't think so.
It's a plight that's all too familiar.
Queensland is absolutely the epicentre of Australia's housing crisis.
Amy McVeigh is the CEO of QCOS, the Queensland Council of Social Service. She says the state's rapid population growth has increased the number of homeless people by 22% in 4 years, triple the national average.
So while we require a nation-building exercise, meaning we need houses all across Australia, we need a particular focus here in Queensland.
She says the state government's commitment to 1,300 new social and affordable homes a year isn't enough.
In order to really make inroads, we need to have about 11,000 new properties supplied each year in Queensland.
And QCOS is calling for more temporary accommodation.
In the short term, there are things we can do. We can make better use of existing government-owned and community-owned assets.
Tenants in the private rental market are also under pressure. In just 10 days this month, the advice service Tenants Queensland received 195 complaints about rent rises, with the average increase 24%. The state government is considering limiting rent hikes to once a year, and Tenants Queensland CEO Penny Carr hopes it follows through.
So we want rent to be limited to increased once per year. We want the CPI to be used as the benchmark.
But she says there's little point capping the frequency of rent increases without tightening eviction rules.
We think there should always be a ground, a reason in law that a tenancy is ended.
A spokesperson for the Queensland Housing Minister, Leanne Enoch, says the government will have more to say after today's Housing Roundtable, which will be attended by representatives from more than 40 organisations.
Any guest reporting there. A year after the collapse of a funeral insurance scheme that targeted low-income First Nations people, its victims are still waiting for compensation. More than 30,000 people are thought to have been left out of pocket when the Aboriginal Community Benefit Fund went out of business. Now, some of those customers from the most remote parts of the country are travelling to Canberra to again plead for help. Erin Park reports.
Sitting on a shady beach on the shores of Roebuck Bay in Broome, Vanessa Polina feels a sense of calm.
It's one of the high tides of the year and it's slowly receding and it's got a beautiful breeze, it's overcast, we've got families down here.
But she's haunted by the collapse of a funeral insurance fund that's left her and tens of thousands of others out of pocket.
Over the course of over 20 years, I reckon close to over 20 grand. For myself and three daughters.
And what did that mean for your family to be putting that much into it?
Way back when it wasn't easy, leaving 12 bucks in the bank and meant going and when the tide went out and foraging for food and stuff, but it was really important, I felt, way back when to leave the $12 in the bank. I mean, that $12 could have bought a lot of food back then.
In March last year, the Aboriginal Community Benefit Fund, which was also known as ACBF or UPLA, collapsed. Only a fraction of the hundreds of millions of dollars it had collected has been recovered.
For the past year, nearly everyone we've spoken to has been in a state of complete disbelief and distress and anger.
Lawyer Mark Holden is a Dungari man who's helping represent the claimants in negotiations with the federal government. He says it has a moral responsibility to compensate people because regulators failed to shut down ACBF and because for 16 years it was allowed to take premiums out of Centrelink payments.
So over 30,000 people have lost out and there is a direct relation between what the government's done and the harm that's been caused here today.
With the federal budget being finalised, he's hoping the government will show compassion.
Put it this way, if you were to have a major insurer and if you were to have them sell a pseudo-financial product to vulnerable people and also have government endorsements over it, then the whole entire public will lose their mind 20 years ago.
In the last 8 months, the federal government has paid out $1.3 million to cover funeral costs for 149 people who've died without the coverage they'd paid for. But there's been no news on a federal government-funded compensation scheme, although the Minister for Indigenous Australians, Linda Burney, has previously said the government is aware of the massive emotional and financial impact and is working on a resolution. Vanessa Polina is part of a delegation meeting with federal ministers this week as part of a national campaign to secure that compensation. She's also hoping further safeguards will be put in place to protect vulnerable consumers.
As much as we don't want to say that it's a black and white issue, the system is broken. You know, it's a collaborative energy that's going to help us get our money back.
Liquidators are investigating the company to see if any laws have been broken and if further assets can be recovered.
Erin Park reporting. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast.
Is there any place left for conservative politics in Australia? The New South Wales election result suggests not, with the entire mainland now red, with Labor in power everywhere except Tasmania. Today, a public policy expert on why coalition parties have lost touch with what most voters want. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.